Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. And today we are talking about what factors make films good. Because, of course, we tend to dunk on woke films and how we talk about how bad things are getting, how things are carbon copies or remakes. But I think it'd be nice to actually talk about what makes them nice. We've done this for music before, haven't we? Where we talked about what makes music good. And now we're going to do the same for film.
I only want to be negative. I just want to trash on movies and say why they're bad.
Get it all out of your system. Get it all out of your system right now. What's your least favorite
Junk.
Film ever?
There are many.
There's too many.
Me, I want to answer.
All right.
I remember watching the film Magnolia, which is, you know, seen by critics as one of the best character acting dramas going, and it was 3 hours of utter teeth pulling.
It's Paul Anderson, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, who did There Will Be Blood.
But I thought it was boring, pretentious, and frustrating.
I've heard very mixed things about it, like that. But at least There Will Be Blood.
That's a fantastic
film. Is one of the best films ever made. And if we're going to be positive, let's start off with talking about something like that. There Will Be Blood.
Okay, what are some of our favorite films before we get going? Let's start.
Okay, who wants...
Stelios first.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say that I would put Lord of the Rings as number one. I don't want to discern between
all three of them.
It's like picking between children, but also the Two Towers.
Yes.
Let's not get into that. Let's not start any arguments.
A punch-up.
And then I would say The Gladiator.
That's a great film, yeah.
Number two. So... that's good for... and then possibly Aliens, the sequel to Alien.
That's probably my favorite out of all of the sort of universe of the Alien franchise.
Yes, and it has huge rewatchability. And The Thing. The Thing by John Carpenter. Walls,
oh yeah, The Thing's fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Although I will say, having watched it only once, but still it was a very impactful watch, I do now prefer At the Mouth of Madness to The Thing, of John Carpenter's work. Mm.
And I suggested it to you. Mm. Did I
yes,
not?
Yes, yeah. You did. I'd already been thinking about watching it, but you reminded me, so thank you very much.
I gave you four movies.
It is a good film.
I think it's your turn to...
me? Okay, well, I think 2001, A Space Odyssey is my favourite. Mm. I've got a very soft spot for Kubrick, as I'm sure we'll find out.
As everybody should.
Yes. I think the Lord of the Rings films are obviously... some of the best. I read the books as a kid, so there's also that added nostalgia, plus they are fantastic. Another Kubrick pick, but Full Metal Jacket should be up there somewhere. I think it's probably my favourite war film going.
It's pretty high up there.
What else is there? I quite like the film Seven.
That's
a good film. I feel like I need to throw in a curveball, don't I? Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That's one of my favourite films of all time as well. That one doesn't tend to get picked very much, but as part of it is that...
especially of Gilliam's works.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a mixed one for him, as far as I'm concerned. And from what I've seen from other people as well.
Mm-hmm. That's directed by Terry Gilliam, who's one of the Pythons. And I like that film largely because of the great acting by Depp and Del Toro. But also the fact that There are lots of interesting editing and camera tricks that sort of portray the state of mind of both the main characters on the various drugs they're taking and the sort of madness of it, the pointlessness of it. And there's a... It almost seems like it wasn't a film in a way, because there's not really a clear plot. It's sort of chaos. I like that.
Slightly controversial point. I will say something that will definitely make you think less of me. I've tried 3 times to watch A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Most I did was 20 minutes. I fall asleep every time.
Could you not get past the intro sequence in prehistoric times?
Just grow up, evolve.
Just still, you're staring at prehistory going, evolve already, come on.
You must hate going to the zoo. But no, to be honest, it actually took me a couple of times to watch A Space Odyssey, because it's a slow burn, and I fell asleep the first 2 times I tried to watch it. And on the third attempt, I watched it all the way through and loved it to bits.
Okay.
So it's worth sticking with, but it is a slow
burn. I will at some point.
And it's one of those films, it's a bit like, it's like the sort of film equivalent of Radiohead. You need a few listens or a few watches to really get into it.
Really showing your hipster credentials right there. Yeah.
Hey, I'm one beard away from being a hipster, and you know, I need the glasses and that's it. I collect records, I drink IPAs, I listen to music nobody's heard of. Subtly gay.
Yeah.
What about overtly gay?
Well, we've not got quite there yet. Get a few drinks down you.
Yeah. It's
Harry, we haven't heard your top
true.
Movies.
Yeah, I will cover some trodden ground here and say, obviously, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, mm-hmm. extended versions.
Of course. Anything less is blasphemy.
Stanley Kubrick, I would also include The Shining there. I think
that's a great one. Yeah.
As a standalone horror film, The Shining is perfectly constructed. I would say there's not a moment wasted in that mm-hmm. whole film. Everything is as effective as it can be for creating the maximum tension. I think that's brilliant. Here's a curveball. Hot Fuzz is definitely mm-hmm. one of my favorite films of all time.
I like Hot Fuzz, but I wouldn't rank it among my favorites.
As a pure comedy, as well as incorporating the action and thriller elements, I think it's amazing. I will also throw in, as a mainstream film, I'm going to say the first 3 Pirates of the Caribbean films.
They are good.
Are three of my favorite action-adventure mm-hmm. films ever made. And mm-hmm. I can't really differentiate between them, because the first one's perfect, but also the other two as a duo of films are perfect and round out the story that the first one set up.
I think the second one is probably my favorite out of those, because I like the Kraken as a sort of anti-hero. This sort of unspoken, unseen behemoth beneath the waves, and the music for the Kraken is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like the dum-dum-dum-dum. Like that in the background, so menacing.
I'm also going to throw out the first 3 films of Robert Eggers.
I was going to mention Robert Eggers,
a very new filmmaker who is probably the only filmmaker I'm interested in who's been putting out new works, new and original works, in the past 10 years. I think he's fantastic, and I can't wait to see what he does with his Nosferatu remake, which is going to be really interesting. And because it's me, I have to. Basically, all of David Lynch's works, post and including Blue Velvet, are basically perfect, even if Inland Empire is one of the most confusing films I've ever seen in my life.
It's very difficult.
I do like Dune. I think Dune gets a bad rap, although I will say... From the 3/4 point or 2/3 point onwards, it really, you can see where they had to cut out like 2 hours of the film, and mm-hmm. it gets really, really rushed, which is a shame, because otherwise it would have been a masterpiece.
Yeah, I love
Lynch. Can you imagine if he had chosen, as he was offered to do, to direct Return of the Jedi?
Oh.
And he chose Dune instead.
We're in the wrong universe. We need to go to a parallel universe where this happened.
I need to see David Lynch's Jabba the Hutt.
I would trade it all in to watch that David Lynch Star Wars.
I know, that'd
that's
be
not
amazing.
True.
But yeah, those are my picks. I know I picked quite a few, but there's such a broad breadth to film, and especially quality film, that I think just narrowing it down to one is narrowing yourself a bit too much.
Josh, you said that mm-hmm. you were annoyed by some movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to hear also what Harry was annoyed. And I want to say, for instance, a movie I was very much annoyed with was Tenet. by Christopher Nolan.
I saw this in the cinema, and I wholeheartedly agree with this. It was difficult to follow, and not in a way where it's sort of artistic and interesting and complex. In a way that is just, I can't be bothered to invest my time and energy in following this, so I'm just going to watch it like a Michael Bay film, in that it's just spectacle and you're not meant to switch your brain on.
Very gratuitous.
It was, yeah. And it was also a silly plot in that the main character was basically risking the world to save this one woman who he'd just met. And there wasn't enough of an incentive for him to do that. So he was employed, I can't remember the exact plot because I only saw it once because it sucks. Isn't he working for like an alphabet agency trying to save the world from...
I don't remember. I tried to erase it from my memory.
Yeah, from like clashing timelines.
In my mind, it's that annoying film.
Mm.
That's fair. And on the point, I will say one of the worst things about films in general is that save for maybe a handful that I've seen, the alphabet agencies in America, and this is included even in some of my favorite films and TV shows, are almost universally portrayed as being forces for good, which they are not.
Twin Peaks, for example.
Yes, sadly, Twin Peaks has that, which I forgive it because the rest of it is so wonderful.
Also in Twin Peaks, though, Dale Cooper, the excellent lawman, does get investigated by the FBI.
For doing the right thing outside of regulation. Yeah. And it's stated pretty much outright that the unit that you're following in Twin Peaks is kind of its own autonomous part of the FBI that doesn't interact much with the rest of it. But either way, you know, lots of films are very, very guilty of that. For a film that really annoyed me, though, I'm going to go with... I don't know if either of you will have ever heard of it. It was a Netflix original film, Spanish language, called The Platform.
Yes, I've watched it.
It's tripe. Utter garbage. It is one of the worst things I've ever watched that was a complete waste of time. If you take the film as a literal linear narrative, nothing in it makes sense. Every character decision, every part of the world building of the universe that it establishes, even down to how the platform itself works, because it's a large tower block that has, 666 floors. Oh my goodness, the symbolism where it has a large platform floating in between each of these floors, and it has food on it, and the people at the top, they get more food, and they try and get as much as possible, and as it goes down, people further and further down in this tower block get less and less food. It's a prison block that you put inmates in, but also you can volunteer to go in there for some reason. There are humanitarian issues where people, like journalists, know what's going on in there, but also they volunteer to go in there. And in the course of the film, a journalist goes in so she can investigate it, thinks to herself, yeah, I'll be locked into a prison cell for a year with somebody who I don't know, who might be a murderer, who might just murder me. And I'm going to take my dog into this situation when we're in a situation where you know that you might have limited resources for food. So obviously somebody is going to eat your dog. Guess what happens? Somebody eats her dog.
And are you sure it's not set in China?
It's just rubbish. It's rubbish. So if you take it as a literal narrative, it's the worst thing I've ever seen.
Also, the worst
writing. Has some very funny scenes, though.
What, you mean when the guy poos on another man's head?
Okay, or, that makes me want to see it after all of that.
It's not worth it. It's not worth it. It's like a less than 5 second shot in a sea of turds. The whole film is a giant turd.
I don't need to watch it. I have Swindon Town Centre. It's fine.
Yeah. And then if you take it as a metaphorical narrative, if you take it from something that's supposed to be interpreted, it is the most on the nose, hammer to the face subtle kind of metaphor for, ooh, capitalism is when the bigwigs at the top get more and the people at the bottom are just fighting for scraps and everybody ends up down in hell.
But the panacotta is the message. Mm-hmm. Remember.
Whoever wrote that, quit. Quit. You deserve to be working in a McDonald's kitchen as the cleaner. Please stay away from film forever. Netflix, you greenlit it. I know you've greenlit some pretty sus stuff in the past, but please shut down your entire service for putting that on my recommended feed.
I know you watch this, Netflix, so listen to him. But no, some things that I don't like. Anything with a superhero in it, other than the Christopher Nolan Batman films, is an avoid for me. Anything that's a remake of an already good film...
the most unnecessary kinds of remakes. Yeah. If you're going to remake something that sucked and make it good.
Yes. Like, you didn't even need to remake The Wicker Man. The original's fantastic. You remade it.
Sorry,
and made it
you
worse.
Had to do it.
I will at least do it. I'll make an exception for that. And to be fair, we did just mention Robert Eggers. He's remaking Nosferatu, which was good, but I'm excited to see a different interpretation.
Yeah, but and I know that he's going to bring something to the table, right? I like Nicolas Cage as an actor, but in that remake, it lost all of its charm that made the original good.
Yes, but it's so bad that it's good.
But it gained a new, different kind of charm, which is Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage, trying to avoid bees. Weekend at Bernie's, that film, and made a mockery of it. That's what he did.
But he does, at one point, dress up as a bear and punch a woman in the face.
I can do that myself if I want to.
Do you remember the scene with the bees?
Yeah, that's a deleted scene.
That's the funniest scene.
That's not even in the main cut of the film. That's a deleted scene that, despite being deleted, was so funny that it still became famous.
Mm-hmm. So let's actually get on to the content of what makes films good, I suppose, although we have obviously touched on it somewhat. And that, I think the first thing and the primary thing is writing and storytelling. I think that's indisputable, really. That's very important. You know, movies are meant to tell a story. They're meant to have a narrative. If they do not, people tend to be confused. In fact, it tends to be like an art house film or something.
I've already
very
mentioned
strange.
Inland Empire. So I'm actually happy for films that have, at best, threadbare plot, as long as the other cinematic techniques that it's using to convey mood and atmosphere are effective enough. But yes, generally, you want a story.
Yes. So I think it needs to be quite well structured, but not always. Like, I like a film...
One of
like,
your favourites, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
That's not particularly well structured, but then that plays into the rampant drug abuse in the film, and so the chaos of it elevates the tone of the film. Or you get things like The Big Lebowski, where, you know, there's a narrative, there's a story, there's a plot, but nothing really happens, nothing's really resolved. Everything kind of ends up back where it was. But I like that because that also reflects the vibe of the film.
That also, there is an argument to say that reflects reality probably a lot more than a typical structured narrative, because the typical structured narrative has resolutions, it has endings, whereas in real life, you don't. Other than very few situations, you don't. Obviously, as a storytelling experience, it can come across very unsatisfying. But with The Big Lebowski, it was used more as a framework to have zany scenarios and comedic situations.
Yeah, I thought it worked really well. And because the sort of vibe of the main character, the dude, played by Jeff Bridges, is kind of laid back and he's sort of got this Eastern philosophy thing, everything kind of circling back to where it began, sort of ties in quite nicely with the ethos that he has towards life. That, you know, things don't change in the grand scheme of things, man. That sort of thing. But
Stelios, you seem to have something to add.
No, I really like the Big Lebowski. And I genuinely like Jeff Bridges.
Oh, he's a fantastic
actor. He's great,
actor.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is a bit tangential, but I think one of the most interesting phenomena is the old Tron. Jeff Bridges, and I think that's really weird because it, as far as I'm concerned, it's a movie whose concept is so far ahead its time that it ended up being really badly portrayed in the first movie. I mean, you can't, it's unwatchable, but it's unwatchable in a good sense.
I've got a funny story about that, which is that my dad as a child always went on about Tron because my dad's really old. So it was groundbreaking for him when it first came out. Like, it was groundbreaking for so many to see CGI used in a film like that. And to be fair, I will give it one thing. It worked within the limitations of CGI that they had at the time to create a really distinctive visual style where the art style of it, I think, transcends the limits. So I think parts of it still look quite good. But when I eventually got around to watching it, I was about 13 years old. It was the most boring film I think I'd ever seen.
They didn't have the means to portray the idea well, I think, at that point.
I know I sort of complained about remakes, but I did quite enjoy the remake of
Same.
Tron.
It wasn't a remake, it was a sequel.
Tron, was it really?
Tron Legacy.
Right. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it was a,
shows
it,
how
it
much
was,
I know.
It was one of those sequels that comes 30 years after the original, but I think this might be the one time when it was justified because the technology had caught with the initial idea.
Yeah. And one thing that I think you'll all agree with me on is plot holes ruin pretty much any film that they're in.
They certainly can do.
The Star Wars sequels, you know, lots of plot holes in them, as well as lots of other things as well. Mm.
One of those other things being overt and terrible political messaging. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that a film can't have a political message to it, even something that the entire film is centered around. But when it comes down to the characters are literal embodiments of modern political talking points, or even as we get less and less subtle as the years go on, we get to the point where a character will almost look straight into the camera and address the audience and tell them exactly what they're thinking and what they should believe.
There's
That's
a reason
awful writing.
People don't break the fourth wall in conventional filmmaking. It's because it breaks the illusion that you're watching a film, and you shouldn't do it unless, you know, it's like a comedy and it's meant to be irreverent and not taken seriously in the first place.
Of course, and to be fair, when it comes to plot holes, even though one of my big problems with The Platform was that it's full of plot holes, it's Swiss cheese is what that plot is made from. I can forgive inconsistencies and a few slip-ups here and there, as long as the film is still emotionally resonant, because I think what we're getting at is that a story needs to be emotionally resonant, because stories are for people, and so they need to reflect people. They need to be an expression of somebody's authorial artistic intent, mm-hmm.
and not an expression of how much the investors want returns on their investment.
Yes, and I think one of the big problems is that the storytelling really is an art. It's the art of being able to express the human condition and human emotion and artistic intent through a narrative and through characters. And one of the most important parts of writing that is to have characters that are different from one another and relatable and have their own voice. And one of the problems with modern filmmaking that I'm referring to here when I say that they might as well just look in the camera is that lots of characters all speak in the same voice these days, because the writers are not skilled enough to be able to come up with people who they can put down on the page and let the character guide them. When you read somebody, fantastic authors and writers talk about the creative process, they create this character that's so full and three-dimensional, but that by the time you're maybe a few episodes in or a few pages into writing the script, it's like the character is guiding them along with the actions, because it would only make sense for this character in this situation to act in that way. And that's why you could say that writing the act of inspiration, it's almost like there is an authorial hand outside of yourself guiding you through that inspiration. Like an example, just to finish off the point, would be Rust in the first series of True Detective. He is one of the most well-fleshed out characters I've ever seen in any television show or film. And I can only imagine his character in the situations that he's put in behaving in that way, speaking in the way that he does. He's not just a blank slate for the author to spew nonsense onto. He feels like you could pluck him out and put him in the real world.
Mm. One thing that kind of stuck with me was I saw an interview with George R.R. Martin, and obviously he's not a filmmaker, but he said you basically build the world and then just kind of deduce what your characters would do. You don't think, oh, I want them to have this confrontation, or, you know, I want them to do this, that, or the other. You create the characters with certain personality traits and just kind of mentally throw them in the ring and see what happens, if you will. And I think that's the way the writers should approach story writing in this sense.
And that's where you end up with some stories where you get major plot contrivances when the characters don't behave in the way that they should, simply because the author has the desire to put them in a situation that ends up feeling artificial. Mm. What a lot of writers will end up doing, and I, once again, this is something I've read in many interviews, where they say the initial inspiration for a film or a character is you get this idea in your head of one really cool scene, one really interesting thing that happens. And then the way to get to that isn't that you just write whatever nonsense will get you there. You have to construct something that will logically flow to get you to that point. And a lot of writers and filmmakers don't do that anymore. They just want to get to the good stuff. They want to get to the money shot, but they don't want to build to it.
Where all the superheroes are fighting the villains and it's all a big battle with lots of CGI explosions.
Let me add something. When it comes to plot holes, and feel free to tell me if I haven't exactly understood the issue, but it seems to me that when we're talking about plot holes, there are all sorts of things that could go wrong with the plot. And sometimes, if what we are seeing doesn't make sense, it can be portrayed in a good way, but it can also be portrayed in a horrific way. And the example that comes to mind is the, at least as far as I see it, the distinction between Last Action Hero by Arnold Schwarzenegger and Deadpool. Now, I'm going to say something that may frustrate some people, but I think Last Action Hero is, in a sense, a very postmodern film. And it, if you compare it with conventional films, you do say it's full of plot holes, but it is given in a way that it's nice, and it is self-referential in a subtle way. Whereas Deadpool has all sorts of absurdities, and it goes over the top where he constantly looks at the camera and he says, "I'm in a movie," where it's self-referential, but not in a subtle way. It's like saying, "I'm in a movie." No, things don't make sense. They're not supposed to make sense. Does this make sense?
Yes, I agree with what you're saying. I would say that Deadpool, and this is a fault in a lot of the comic books as well, post-90s Deadpool comic books, they fall into the Family Guy trap of just assuming that if I point out that here is a modern reference that you will understand if you are watching this contemporarily, or if I just point out that I'm in a television show or a movie, the audience is expected to laugh. It's almost like it's applying social pressure to you that I've not made a joke, I've just made you aware of something and you should at least chuckle at it, just out of politeness.
I just couldn't find it funny or couldn't relate to it.
It's kind of tedious and it's
annoying.
It's not even low-hanging fruit. It's like picking rotten fruit off the ground.
Yeah. It's just annoying.
Yes. So another thing to do with writing and storytelling is interesting characters. And two directors who I think do this quite well are Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers.
Mm.
They always have very memorable characters.
In The Big Lebowski, doesn't he only show up in two scenes?
Yes.
And yet he's incredibly memorable because of how weird he is in those scenes. There's a few ways to make a memorable character. There's the ways where we talk about like a Rust Cole who's incredibly fleshed out and fascinating and you want to learn more about him. And then there is coming up with somebody who is really weird. But I'd say the way to make that work is to make them feel weird in an authentic way.
David Lynch also does it well, doesn't he?
Yes.
The word weird triggered my recollection of his work.
It was very Lynchian. he does lots of weird characters, and the Coen brothers do lots of weird characters, but they're weird in a way that feels authentic and real.
Yeah, they've got sort of idiosyncrasies that you can imagine an actual person having. It's not just, oh, look at how weird this person is that has this quirk that you've never seen in life.
Yeah, they feel weird in a way that feels correct for the eccentric weirdo who lives at the end of the road.
Mm.
Whereas, in contrast, M. Night Shyamalan makes very weird characters in all of his films that feel completely unnatural. This character is just obsessed with, I don't know, milk cartons or something. That's his one character trait. And that's the thing about making weird characters. They can't just be that one character trait.
You mean a one-dimensional character is not interesting?
Yeah, they can't just be that. Just having them be weird by itself isn't enough.
I think it has to do with how iconic some scenes are. Because, this may be a sort of a cheating example because it's from a book. But I think that in Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins plays just for 16 minutes.
Mm.
It's not the entire movie that he appears on. Yet the character is very central to the movie, and every time he appears, it just makes the most out of all these seconds.
I think his fantastic acting, though,
Generally, it's not
really
just
really carries the
well,
role.
That, yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get onto the acting, but
that's the thing after the writing and storytelling.
It's all part of the package, isn't it? It needs to come into a holistic package.
Mm-hmm. What about the aspect of character development as well? Because it's not essential. Sometimes you can have a character not change that much in a film, and it doesn't necessarily matter.
For instance,
yeah, exactly.
He doesn't learn anything. In fact, that's a pretty common thing through Coen Brothers films, where the characters. Yeah. Don't have an arc, they don't learn.
No Country for Old Men is a great example because they explicitly say at the end, well,
you're thinking of Burn After Reading.
You're right, yeah.
What did we learn from this? I don't know.
That is a Coen Brothers film though, isn't it?
It is. It's great.
In No Country for Old Men, they're talking about not knowing what to make of what has happened still.
Mm.
You know,
the primary character, the protagonist, dies 3/4 of the way through the film.
Off camera.
Yeah. Killed by somebody unrelated to the rest of the plot, which is quite a brave move.
I was very confused. I thought that the version of the film I downloaded had skipped something.
I can understand why you would think that.
But yes, can either of you think of a good example of a sort of film that looks at character development? Because I think it certainly makes a film investing. Because
Pulp Fiction.
That's true. Yep.
Jules Winfield.
Yeah, that's a good example. Mm.
I think that's an interesting example with, where he sort of finds his religious path.
Yes.
That was interesting. Yeah.
Butch also has a character development as well, doesn't he? To a certain extent, in that he goes back and saves Marcellus Wallace from the creepy dudes. Yeah,
from Zed.
That's the one, yeah.
I think... Pulp Fiction's a really good example as well, because Jules is informed by the framework of the plot around him as well, and from Tarantino's decision to show the events in a non-linear order. So you can see the consequences of the life that Jules could have taken in what happens to Vincent. And then you see his decision at the end as rounding out the character development for himself.
But also, if he were there, maybe Vincent wouldn't have died. Thank you for watching that clip from my series Contemplations. If you want to sign up to the website for £5 a month, you can access that series, which comes out 1 p.m. every Saturday. Thank you for watching, and goodbye.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.